This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Get ready. We're going to visit the hot Arctic, where the winter sea ice is almost refusing to form. It's at a record low for November. Climate scientist Paul Beckwith will tell us why the sea ice around the world is in retreat and what it means for our weather. Yes, we'll get to Trump, the chances of hope, and the planetary climate emergency. Then something completely different. From the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, Dr. Klaus Lackner will explain our options for capturing carbon right from the atmosphere. It may be our only chance to save the climate we all need to survive. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. In the summer of 2007, you could hear the thud of scientists' jaws dropping all over the world as they watched the Arctic sea ice almost vanish. It was a world wake-up call on global warming. This year, as we languished in the media tsunami of the American election, there has been another great turning point. It's like a climate change siren blaring from the dark Arctic sea, and we are just too far away to hear it. But know it or not, we will suffer the consequences. Here to explain is one of our favorite climate scientists and Arctic watcher, Paul Beckwith. Paul has two master's degrees. He's working on his PhD on extreme climate change. He teaches at the University of Ottawa in Canada, and he educates us all with his YouTube videos. Paul Beckwith, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex.
Well, you know, talking with you, Paul, it's kind of like visiting the emergency room doctor. It's not because we're doing great. This time we've got a broken Arctic. What's the big deal there?
Well, I guess the point is that all of the data from the Arctic is unprecedented. You know, at the risk of being attacked by Washington Post for saying unprecedented, as I was on the jet streams, like there's no other way to describe it. The temperatures are off the chart, 20 degrees Celsius temperature anomaly. So that's 20 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, which is 36 degrees Fahrenheit for our American listeners. As a result, the ice is not forming properly. Where the sea ice minimum occurred on September 8th or 9th, which is surprised a lot of people because people expected with the rates of decline that it would be maybe a week or two later. You know, even normally it's about mid-September. And as the ice is trying to grow in extent now, as we move through end of November into through winter, then the ice tries to grow, but the water surrounding the ice is very, very warm, much warmer than normal, and that's just melting it back. And also there's tremendous amounts of the thickest ice in the Arctic, which is bunched up just north of the Canadian archipelago, which is being exported by the wind patterns through the Fram Strait between Greenland and Svalbard. And this ice is going into the open Atlantic Ocean and completely being melted out extremely fast there. So we're also having a lot of ice that has moved between the islands and the Canadian archipelago, and that's also melting. You know, this is happening on a continuous basis. There will be a lot of variation, but, you know, we set the second lowest record with the September minimum ice extent, and now we've been setting records for lowest ice this time of year. And it's because the Arctic temperatures, they're 2 months behind in terms of cooling down. I mean, we're basically seeing temperatures in the Arctic now that we should be seeing in September.
All right. Now, just to be clear, was the Arctic sea ice at an all-time record low this summer of 2016?
This summer, it was the second lowest. It was behind the previous record of 2012, and it was very close but slightly lower than the previous record of 2007 that you talked about in the introduction.
But now the problem is it should be forming and hardening up and getting ready for another season, and it's just not doing it the way it's supposed to.
Yes, that's correct. As it attempts to grow, which it does every year, we have very good satellite data from 1979 onwards, and you can compare the curves of all of the years, and we're well below where we would be expected to be this year. Not only that, the sea ice in Antarctica is dropping off of a cliff, and it's much lower than we've ever seen it there. So when you look at the total global sea ice on the planet, then because of the rapid drop in Antarctica and because of the record lows in the Arctic, they add to something which is completely off the charts. I mean, it's just, this is a measure of how quickly our planet is warming from all of these, all of the feedbacks that are in play.
Well, that's one of the things the doubters tend to say. They say, well, maybe it's shrinking in the Arctic, but the Antarctic sea ice is expanding, so the poles are just balancing out. Who cares? But they're behind the times now. That isn't what's happening, as you've just said.
Yeah, it's just the most striking plot is actually, if you look at the graph of global sea ice, which is Arctic plus Antarctic, and it's because we're setting records at both poles, the combination is the most striking. Yeah, I mean, our climate system is changing in ways that were, are they unexpected? Well, with these type of temperatures, you expect the ice to melt much faster. But, you know, these type of temperatures that we're seeing at the poles are way off the scale. In fact, if you compare this year's temperature to pre-industrial, you know, we're well over that 1.2, 1.3 degrees. There were entire months, for example, the entire month of February was almost up to that 2 degrees above the pre-industrial 1750 sort of values, because from 1750 to sort of the 1880 to 1910 average, there was about a 0.3 degree Celsius rise. From the 1880 to 1910 average to the 1950s to 80 average, say, there was another 0.3 roughly, and then you need to add the 1.25 that everybody's talking about, but that's relative to, you know, the 1950 to 81 averages roughly. So then you get a total of 1.95 degrees for February 2016 over the 1750 value. So we're talking about Paris levels, that 2-degree limit in Paris, you know, well above the 1.5 degrees. I mean, that's just for 1 month, granted, but, you know, when the tally comes in for 2016 overall, you know, we're going to be way off of the charts. And, you know, also we will be for CO2 rise as well. I mean, the CO2, which is very worrying because the global sinks of carbon dioxide, namely the oceans and the soils and the vegetation, the trees and so on, are failing. And as a result, the International Energy Agency numbers, which are showing supposedly that human emissions have stabilized, you know, are expected to be similar in 2016 to 2015, which was not much higher than 2014 or 2013. So kind of flattening off. And yet we're setting, in 2015, the CO2 rose a record 3.05 parts per million. And this year, I wouldn't be surprised if it's between 4 and 5 parts per million rise. So this is a very rapid acceleration, and it must indicate that the global sinks are reducing. The oceans are warmer, more stratified, so they're not absorbing as much of the CO2. We're getting tremendous fires in the boreal forests and also destruction of the Amazon rainforests. And so we're losing the sinks, the carbon dioxide sinks on the planet. So it's getting out of control. I mean, we need to declare a global climate change emergency.
All right. Well, you are like visiting the emergency room doctor. So before we get to some of your solutions, I do want to get back to the Arctic science. And even before we do that, though, I think people need to realize that these changes in the sea ice, even in the fall, could affect us right here where most of us live, in North America, in Europe, in Russia. How does that work?
Yes. Well, the Arctic is getting darker because we're getting a rapid decline of sea ice, which is a white surface that reflects a lot of incoming sunlight during the summers in the Arctic. And as bad as the sea ice decline is, the snow cover over the land in the spring is declining at about double the rate that the sea ice is declining. And Greenland is melting a lot more, and we're getting lakes forming on the surface, which are dark surfaces on top of the white ice. And as the ice melts back, it's uncovering a lot of the dust and dirt and stuff that's embedded in the ice. So the whole Arctic region is darkening, and it used to reflect about on average about 52% of the incoming solar radiation. And now, according to NASA, it's as of a few years ago even, it was reflecting only 48% of the incoming light. So that additional 4% of light is being absorbed by the surface, leading to additional heating in the Arctic, which is causing the Arctic temperatures to rise much larger than the global average, and certainly much larger than the equator temperature, because the equator temperature doesn't change too much. When there's more heat at the equator, there's more evaporation of water, which doesn't raise the temperature. So that's kind of moderates and keeps the equator temperature somewhat stable. You know, if you live in a city on the equator, your yearly average temperature might only vary about 2 or 3 degrees. So what this means is that the temperature difference from the equator to the Arctic is getting much, much smaller as the Arctic is warming. And it's this temperature difference that determines the jet streams, how they form at the altitude the planes fly. And it also affects how wavy they are, how fast they are. So they're slowing down because the temperature difference is reduced, and they're becoming wavier and getting stuck. And this is causing the increase in extreme weather events that we're seeing. So we're seeing a higher frequency of torrential rains, for example, much more severe extreme weather, and also the duration is, these events are lasting longer. So we're getting many cities flooded out because their infrastructure just cannot handle 3, 4, 5 months of rain in a night or two, which is happening commonly at cities. So we're changing basically the heat balance on the planet. Heat moves from hot areas, the equator, to the poles, and it does it about a third of the heat's transported in the ocean current, two-thirds in the atmosphere. And because the poles are so much warmer, there's less heat transfer. So the current ocean currents are changing, the atmospheric currents, namely the jet streams, are changing. So there's more heat moving to the southern hemisphere as a result, and that heat is changing. It's also causing extreme weather events in the southern hemisphere. So it's a global issue, and things are changing so fast. I mean, the flora and fauna, plants and animals, are stressed, and they're migrating quickly, and we're getting human migration as well, which is leading to nationalism and popularism and things like Brexit and Trump.
Well, I think you were the one who coined the phrase, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. And for those paying attention, it's been brutally cold in Eastern Europe and even worse in Russia and Central Siberia, and they expect cold winters. There have been hundreds of record low temperatures. They've had to close schools. The daytime temperature failed to reach minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 34 C. Japan just had their first November snow in 54 years. It almost looks like what should have been the polar cold has slipped down into the Asian continent. Could that be related to changes in the Arctic or the unpredictability you've been talking about?
Yes. Coincidentally, just in the last half hour, I've been reading some papers from Nature magazine, the latest issue, and there's one particular one about how the polar vortex has shifted over towards Asia and Europe in the last 30 years. And they correlate it to the declining sea ice, but it's not just, the sea ice is not declining uniformly in all regions of the Arctic. So if you look at the Barents Sea, which is, and the Kara Sea, which are just off Russia, those regions have lost most of their sea ice for long periods of the year. That's where the ice is, it has decreased more than any other region. So what this does is this adds a lot of water vapor to the atmosphere over that region. That water vapor ends up going over Russia and over parts of Europe, and it drops down on the land as snowfall. So those areas are getting more snowfall, And as a result, the polar vortex has shifted over where it used to be centered right over the sort of the Arctic Ocean region, more or less centered over, you know, the geometrical center of the planet. And because of the changing ice distribution, it's shifted over, and we're getting, as a result, we're getting this massive cold weather over Siberia and parts of Europe with all the snowfall that you just mentioned. And what we're also getting is the whole polar vortex, which is generally the winds, the high altitude winds in the stratosphere over the Arctic, those are actually often being split into two different cold regions, one over the Arctic and one over Asia and Europe. And the split generally occurs right above the Barents and Kara Seas, where the water is exposed, the ice is gone, so those areas are heating up, and that comes up and that can split the vortex into two chunks. And that seems to have happened recently, with the chunk over the Arctic almost dissipating, whereas the one over Asia is much colder and more intense. You have to remember that there's a certain amount of heat on the planet, and that heat, even though there's rapid changes occurring, that amount of heat can't change too quickly. So if the Arctic is crazy warm, where did that cold go? It's got to be somewhere. I mean, it's, you know, over, we're very quickly losing it on the planet, but, you know, you don't lose it in a season. So it's actually been shifting over to Asia and Europe.
You've just taught me something obvious that I didn't really know. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm your downer host, Alex Smith. My guest is Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa. Paul, you recently released a couple of really helpful videos full of graphics on YouTube about this Arctic sea ice problem in November. You talked about wave action. It seemed a little technical, but what should the average person understand about waves and sea ice?
Well, I guess the important thing is that we're changing the physical nature of all the processes that are occurring in the Arctic. So when the sea ice covers ocean water, then as the sea ice thickness increases, then it's a very good insulator of heat. So it keeps the water temperature underneath separated from the air temperature. So basically, when the Arctic is covered with sea ice, it acts more as a continent than as an ocean, in terms of it can get very cold, the air is very dry. So as we lose more and more sea ice, we're turning the Arctic Ocean into a maritime climate. And the feedbacks are extremely strong, because the energy that does come into the Arctic from the sun in the summer, normally a lot of it is used up in melting the sea ice. But when the ice is a lot thinner and not covering as much area or extent, then that energy, it can take out the sea ice quickly, and then it heats up the water to extremely high temperatures. And then the water, because of wave action, there's vertical mixing in the water, so that heat gets transferred down. So you get maybe all the way down to the seafloor if you're on over a continental shelf like the Eastern Siberian Shelf or the Kara Shelf or the Barents Shelf, like just near the coastlines of Russia. So the water can warm all the way down, and then it's that heat can be transferred through the ocean sediment and start thawing out the methane class rates that are there. And then we start getting more methane coming up, and we're seeing this in the Arctic region. And there's all of these different effects that are happening there, which are rapidly changing the planet. Now, Antarctica is a bit more of a mystery, because generally the sea ice there has been growing at about 1.5% per decade over the last few decades in terms of the seasonal extent. And just 2 years ago in 2014, we had a record amount of sea ice around Antarctica that season. It was a very unusual event. It was like less than 1 in 100 year event, I would say. You know, if you look at the statistics, it was well outside 2 standard deviations. And if that means anything to people, it was very unusual. And then this year, it's a record low, and it's plummeting down. So I covered all of these things with some nice graphics and things. They're on my website, paulbeckwith.net. And I did three videos, which I titled Our Climate Emergency and Three-Legged Barstool Survival, I called it. You know, solutions is what I'm really looking at. But, you know, the system is becoming very strange, so I threw in the word survival. And those videos, if you just Google YouTube, Paul Beckwith, you can find these videos. And I'm going to be doing quite a few more on how that's affecting the methane in the Arctic, and among other topics. I mean, I've done well over 100 videos now to try to educate the public about, you know, the risks that we face from climate change, and I've been trying to build the case that, you know, we're in a climate change emergency. The ridges of the jet streams run right up to the North Pole, cause, you know, heating there in the middle of winter. The troughs run right down to the equator, and I argue they cross the equator, joining up with the southern hemisphere jet stream. So we're basically losing seasonality in the northern hemisphere very rapidly. And even the jet stream, the way they operate and the way they carry heat is another enormous feedback to warm the entire northern hemisphere.
Now, you know Dr. Peter Wadhams. He's one of the world's most experienced Arctic scientists. He's the head of the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge. He's a veteran of many expeditions to measure the ice, and he's released a new book this year, A Farewell to Ice. Have you spoken to Peter about the failure of this ice formation this fall?
Peter has been at Marrakesh at the COP22 climate conference, I believe under the invitation of Stuart Scott, who you've had on your program before. You've also had Peter. And Stuart did a whole bunch of press conferences at the COP, including on things like, you know, the impact of meat on climate change. He had a whole session on population. So he tried to hit the big elephants in the room that people don't want to discuss. And he had an entire two press conferences, I believe, Peter, maybe three, but one of them was specifically on the book, on Peter's book, A Farewell to Ice, and another one was on, you know, what's happening right now in the climate system. So I believe those videos, those sessions are all recorded. I believe those videos could probably be found if you go to the websites on the conference, but I know that Stuart will be editing them and posting them all on his YouTube channels, and I'll make sure they send you all the links so you can post some of them so the listeners can see them easily.
Yeah, Stuart sent me an email just yesterday. He just met the Pope, for one thing, briefly, but he met him. And he put a couple of links to some of those videos from Marrakesh, Morocco. But as you say, most of them are still awaiting editing. I'll put the links as they come up in my show blog at ecoshock.info. But please do keep me posted as well. Now, what else have I got here for you? Yeah, we're getting close to out of time, but I did want to get your reaction to Donald Trump. Kevin Anderson, when I spoke to him, worried that another 4 years of lies or delay and more coal could be the very critical 4 years we had to save the climate. Do you think the Donald will doom us, Paul?
Well, so, you know, there's a lot of people that are talking like that, and people talking about it's going to be too late, right, is often said. And I did a whole YouTube video on, you know, what does really too late mean? Because it's already too late for millions of people on our planet. Like if you're living in Bangladesh near sea level, you know, the rise is going to displace you. It's just a matter of time, whether it be 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, you know, 20 years, whatever. You know, is it too late for, you know, us in, say, Canada? There's such an imbalance between the effects of climate change depending on where people live and depending on the wealth of countries. If you're in a country where people spend a third or a half of their income on food, then those people are going to be basically unable to purchase food in a short number of years when abrupt climate change continues to accelerate and severely damages the food supply. I was just at a talk last week by an emeritus professor with Department of Fisheries and Oceans talking about fish farming and the decline of fish in the oceans. He also talked a bit more generally about food, and in the Nature paper that was talking about the polar vortex shifting, there's an article with about 30 different author names, and it's all about decline of yields of grains with temperature. And I skimmed the abstract, and it was pointing out about a 4 to 6% decline in grain yields globally with a 1 degree rise in temperature. Now, that I'm sure it's not taking into account things like the declining sea ice and feedbacks that are kicking in, and it's certainly not taking into account the rises in temperature that we've seen this year in 2016 and the rises in CO2, et cetera, things like that. So whatever Trump does, there's going to be huge impacts. And I think Trump, you know, he says he's a smart businessman. If he's a smart businessman, he'll recognize that gutting the EPA and gutting NASA and climate change research will put the U.S. into a huge recession, and it will basically, you know, have an enormous impact on reducing their technology, their ability to supply the military with advanced weapons. I mean, it will basically crater the economy of the U.S., which will perhaps reduce emissions more than, say, you know, somebody who's experienced and doesn't do these policies, you know, on the top of their head. The big concern is it takes decades to build up an organization like NOAA, for example, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, and these centers of excellence that do tremendous work with the satellites. And it takes decades. And if these can be killed with the stroke of a pen on Inauguration Day, I mean, we're never going to have a chance against climate change. Other countries in Europe, say, get more populous. Ironically, we're getting more migration around the planet because of the impacts of climate change. So to deny that that's causing it is going to make it worse, and the migrant, you know, there's going to be way more migration, and it's going to just set us into a really, really dire global situation. So we need rationality in the decisions that we make. And I do propose, you know, a three-pronged approach to slash fossil fuel emissions, to apply carbon dioxide removal, remove CO2. We need to get the levels back down to 350, and also to cool the Arctic, to keep the methane in place, the sea ice in place, try to restore some stability to the jet streams. And with Trump, you know, that really harms, say, leg one of the bar stool, the slashing emissions. And, you know, it certainly means maybe we have to go a whole hog on leg two and three. But I can't see how we can let one person, no matter who they are, destroy the work of hundreds of other countries. I mean, what, we have 195 countries, you know, in the Paris Agreement, and we're going to say one guy in one country, albeit they have a huge influence, can take down global efforts at retooling to renewables and addressing climate change. Yeah, it really doesn't make sense.
Well, they say it's always darkest just before the dawn, and I trust we'll live long enough to see the dawn. We've been talking with a regular and quite popular guest here on Radio EcoShock in Canada. Paul Beckwith is a climate scientist at the University of Ottawa. He has thousands of followers on his Twitter feed, Facebook page, and YouTube channel. You can get your own education in climate science practically just from Paul's videos. They're available from his website as well at paulbeckwith.net. It's a place to be for science before it's news, I think. Paul, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always wonderful to talk to you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. It looks like we're headed for a different and a difficult climate, unless humans can reverse our pollution by grabbing greenhouse gases right out of the sky. Recently on Radio EcoShock, Dr. Kevin Anderson explained the hazards of counting on carbon capture and storage as we continue to pollute the atmosphere. His paper was published in the journal Science in October 2016. On November 11th, Science published a reply with a more positive view of carbon capture. The author is Dr. Klaus S. Lackner. He's the director of the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions and a professor at Arizona State University. Lackner got his doctorate at physics at Germany's Heidelberg University. He started in atomic work, including a period at Los Alamos National Lab. Then Klaus branched into climate research, including contributing to a report on carbon capture and storage for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Klaus Lackner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Dr. Lackner, why did you write a reply to the paper, The Trouble with Negative Emissions, by Anderson and Peters?
Well, first of all, it wasn't just me. That is the way it came out in Science, because we had 45 authors, and they relegated the majority to the supplement because they couldn't make room enough in the main pages for such a long list of authors. So it wasn't just me, but I was the one who started it. But then we had a large group of people who not only signed up, but helped with the editing and replying to this perspective in Science.
Why did you feel a reply was necessary?
I think the reply is necessary because the way it came across in the perspective, it was not so much that we shouldn't just count on negative emissions. I'm the first person to agree that we shouldn't count on the ability to do this until we actually have done it. But it sort of relegated it as a unjust and high-risk gamble, and thereby sort of implied that we should try to solve the problem just without it. And I don't think that is actually feasible anymore. I actually think we are in a position right now where we most likely will overshoot even if we put in best possible efforts. But we may find that even negative emissions cannot solve the problem anymore. But keeping that half of the response out of the mix is probably an equally risky proposition. In effect, we are already past this point, and even the paper makes it quite clear. It points out that we are currently at 404 parts per million and going up by 2.5 parts per million a year. And if we want to stop at 450 parts per million, we probably cannot do this anymore.
Your article is titled The Promise of Negative Emissions. Let's talk about that in detail. First, please tell us what the Center for Negative Carbon Emissions does.
Well, I started from the perspective that we probably will need negative emissions to balance the carbon budget. So my view of it is, in a way, quite simple. We should think of carbon dioxide we are producing in the consumption of fossil fuels as a waste product we just dump into the atmosphere. And we have by now figured out that we are not allowed to dump it there. And thinking about it as a waste problem rather than a pollution problem actually changes the way you think about it. And I can give you a simple example. If I were to dump my garbage in the street, my neighbors would be very unhappy with me and probably call the cops on me. And they wouldn't take it for an answer that I said, but I thought about it very hard and I made it a lot better by reducing my garbage production and conserving where I can. And this year, it's actually 20% less than last year. But in the climate change debate, we do exactly that. We actually set targets how much we want to reduce this year, where really we have to take the point of view, this is garbage. It's dumped into the atmosphere, and we have to stop doing this. And we may have to take some of it back because we already put so much out that we are over the limit we can possibly afford being out there. So that's where our starting point was. And if you look at the IPCC, you can say that the modelers just willy-nilly invented technologies to have negative emissions. But the other way of looking at is that the modelers were unable to balance the carbon budget in time without having such negative emissions. So to me, it's not so much a question of will the negative emissions work, but what can we do to make them work?
Do you think, though, that the Paris Climate Agreement, which begins with such low demands for reducing national emissions, could they do that if they didn't assume carbon capture technology in the future?
Well, they are starting to put some ambition behind what we should do, and they are asking people to make promises. And if you add up all the promises, it falls woefully short from what needs to be done. Paris, on the other side, is very ambitious. Paris says we have to hold the line below 2 degree warming, and they then turn around and say we should actually stop at 1.5 degree warming. I would make the argument we probably are already at 1.5 degree warming. And the way I mean this is not that we right now have reached 1.5 degree warming, but if we could, by some technology, hold the CO2 level in the atmosphere at about 400 parts per million, it will still get warmer for decades and decades to come because the climate hasn't yet equilibrated to 400 ppm. The oceans still act as a cool spot in the system. We have sort of ice cubes in the glass, and it hasn't warmed up yet, right? So as a consequence, it is not at all clear that if we waited 50, 60 years at 400 parts per million, that we haven't effectively already breached the 1.5 ppm. Therefore, if we want to stay below it, we really will have to pull CO2 back. If the agreement is 2 degree warming is where we should hold the line, then we probably end up around 450 parts per million. Now, at the current rate of emission, that will take us about 16 years.
I understand. Well, now, could you explain for us one of the technologies that people seem to favor, BECCS, the bioenergy with carbon capture and storage idea?
Well, you now are looking for negative emissions, right? And one where we actually know how to do it is BECCS, right? If your power plant were to burn wood rather than coal, and you still collect the CO2 in the flue stack, and you still bury that CO2, then you have created a negative emission, right? What's nice about this particular technology is there is not all that much new that needs to be invented. What's problematic with this technology is that if you wanted to do it at the scale you need to do it, you probably would need more land assigned to BECCS than we currently assign to agriculture. So I don't think by itself it will ever get big enough. It can help. There's not a single solution to the problem. It's sort of one arrow in the quiver. But we need additional options. So we are working on technology and technological means of pulling CO2 back out of the atmosphere. In other words, we are looking at sorbents which bind CO2, and then we can take the CO2 back off the sorbent and keep doing the cycle, so we collect CO2 by that means.
Well, would we have pools of that solvent or something? How would that work?
In our particular case, actually, with one exception, the people who are doing this use solid materials. So in our case, it's a plastic-like material that when it's dry has a very high affinity to CO2, and when you make it wet, it gives it back. So the picture is it's like a tree, we call it a synthetic tree that stands out in the wind, and the leaves of that tree bind CO2 as the wind moves over it, and then ever so often, roughly every an hour, we collect those into a closed box, make it wet, and harvest the CO2 that comes off, process it further on in order to make pure compressed CO2, and then the wet leaves go back into the outside, they dry in the wind, and pick up CO2 again. So that's how you could imagine to do this. And this particular technology and most of the air capture devices are about 1,000 times faster than a tree. The tree is not specialized to collect CO2. It does it because it needs to, but it does many other things.
Do we have the technology right now to capture carbon from smokestacks of power plants?
Yes, we do. We have had this for a long time because we used it for other purposes. We never built it out to a scale where it deals with the CO2 from power plants. But that's just half of the story, right? You fly in an airplane and you drive a car and you move freight over the oceans by ship. All of these things emit CO2. As a matter of fact, the hardest part of the equation to solve is the CO2 which is generated from liquid fuels, right, in the transportation sector. And we cannot leave that out. In other words, we cannot solve the carbon dioxide problem by removing 90% of the CO2 from flue stacks, which make up maybe a third of the total.
Well, supposing we do get it from the flue stacks or we collect it in these trees that you've described, how do we store it?
I don't think at this point we have a choice anymore. It's a simple mass balance. As long as we dig up carbon from the ground, we will have to put it back. Right? And it is quite likely that we already overshot. And even if you do the best you can possibly do, you nearly certainly have overshot. And so very likely we will have to take 100 ppm of CO2, which are in the air, get it back and put it somewhere. Right. So from that perspective, we have no choice. Now, there are multiple options. The currently most favored option, because it's relatively low in cost, is to inject it into underground saline aquifers and keep it there. Right. That has a certain amount of capacity. Whether it has enough can be argued. I had started in 1995 to say we should really do what I would call accelerated geological weathering. If you look at certain rocks, they will react with the CO2 in the air, which in rain comes down as carbonic acid, and make salts, namely carbonates. And if we wait about 100,000 years, that's how the problem we created right now will go away. Right? But the question is, can we do this faster and make mineral carbonates at the scale we need to do? And for example, there is a project in Iceland where people are putting CO2 underground and show that the Icelandic basalts actually form carbonates in less than 2 years. So there are ways of storing carbon dioxide. Unless we are comfortable to live well above 450 parts per million, I think we already have removed the option not to deal with it. And so I don't view carbon sequestration as an excuse to keep on using fossil fuels. I view it as something we probably already have to do in order to balance the books. If 350.org is right or James Hansen is right, and we should not exceed 350 ppm in the air in the long run, we will not get back to 350 ppm in a very, very long time, unless we actively remove carbon dioxide from the air and store it somewhere.
Well, that somewhere can be a problem. I mean, we just saw the deep storage well for natural gas blow out at Aliso Canyon in California. They couldn't stop it for 4 months. What happens if a carbon storage facility leaks out the carbon we thought was safely stored down there?
Then you are right back where you were if you had ignored the problem, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Let me add on this a little. If you can pull CO2 back out of the air, you can actually get it back. Unlike the methane, which comes out of that well, the CO2, unless it's really coming out in vast, vast quantities at one spot, is actually not hazardous, right? It goes into the air and it creates exactly the climate change it would have created if you had let it out in the first place. But if you say, I happen to have just lost 1 million tons of CO2, then in a way you are on the hook to collect another 1 million tons of CO2 and put it back, which is another reason why air capture is so important, right? Because it makes it possible to undo the damage you did. And I think one of the reasons which makes it so hard to move forward, and this is another point where I disagree with Anderson, what makes it so hard to move forward, if I am an emitter and I emit it and you complain, I'm going to shrug my shoulders and say, what are you going to do about it? Right? But if you have the ability to create negative emissions, you can go back and say, well, I pulled it back and you are liable for doing this. You are going to pay for this change. You'd be surprised how fast people will figure out that they are better off to not let the CO2 out in the first place than having to pay for pulling it back later. In other words, I don't see negative emissions necessarily as a way of delaying things. It certainly will have that effect, but it also will accelerate action by making it possible to hold you liable and actually force action which undoes what you just did. Right? And that is new once you have negative emissions. If you have air capture, I give you a simple example. Right now, most of the coal industry says, we understand there is climate change and we are researching to find solutions, but it's so expensive you don't want to do it. And by the way, you need our cooperation. As long as we tell you it's too expensive, nothing will happen. But if you can tell the coal company or the utility which burns coal, okay, that's fine, but then you have to pay for the air capture, which will reverse the CO2 emissions. you'd be surprised how fast they figure out that they can be faster. Right? Air capture shouldn't be for coal plants. It should be for airplanes where you really have a very hard time coming up with another option. But if coal plants do not cooperate, you can always force them to solve the problem this way.
Radio EcoShock.
You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is a distinguished scientist and a leader in the hunt for a way to prevent the worst of climate change. He's Dr. Klaus Lackner from the Arizona State University. You raised a point just now that kind of stimulated me. You said, well, we can go back. And my reading from the scientists I've talked to is likely we can't go back in any ecological way. So many changes have already been put into motion, but at least we could stop the worst from happening. Now, what do you think about that?
I would 100% agree with what you just said, right? And therefore, I always say the ability to have negative emissions, the ability to have air capture is not an excuse to do nothing. Because as we go forward, we create irreversible damages, right? The fact that we come back down in CO2 will not unmelt the glaciers. Once they are molten, once the glaciers have gone away, it'll take a long, long time for them to come back. So, yes, you have irreversible damage. But if your choice is to end up at 500 ppm and stay there, or touch on 500 ppm and come back to 350, which of the two do you think is better?
Absolutely. Now, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions about other technologies that have been advanced. France is proposing changes to agriculture to put more carbon in the soil. It's called the 4 per 1,000 project. What are your thoughts on that as a solution?
I think there are many, many different ways of putting carbon away. And what we need is accounting schemes and metrics which clearly define that we have done that. So what I would like is a certificate of sequestration, or if you prefer, a certificate of negative emissions, which can show you that it has been put away. Then many different things can play. And I would argue BECCS, as well as hiding carbon in agricultural fields, can be a good contributor. I am doubtful that it can reach the necessary scale. We are putting 36 billion tons of CO2 out a year, and I don't think you can come close to that. And in a way, we have worried about deforestation as being a contributor to climate change, but it's a small contributor to climate change. Fossil fuels are the big one, and so doing the opposite will be helpful, but it will not solve the problem.
I'm told Bill Gates is funding research into carbon capture. What do you know about that?
Well, there's a group in Canada Bill Gates has funded, and they are doing very good work. So that's carbon engineering.
And is the U.S. government funding negative emissions research, or would you expect that support to continue under the Trump administration?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's early days. I would hope so. But, I mean, the statements which have been made in the past don't sound encouraging.
Is carbon capture research going ahead well in other countries?
I think the negative emission research is just at the cusp, and it's just starting. And it's not very well positioned. And this is a part of the reason why we had such a large response by so many people to the Kevin Anderson paper, because you get in trouble with both sides, right? If you think climate change is a hoax, why in the world would you want negative emissions, right? And if on the other side, people who say you need to do the purest thing and stop all fossil fuel consumption overnight, and you need to change your lifestyle, and that's the only way to solve the problem, and negative emissions give you an excuse not to do that, therefore it shouldn't be done, you are caught in the middle. The problem is we have had by now 20 years to implement mitigation without negative emissions, and we have done practically nothing, right? And in 1980, we could have had a very good discussion about whether we should or should not have negative emissions because it might delay implementation. But by now, we are so far down the road that I don't think we can make it happen without negative emissions.
I think there's a communications problem, too, because people seem to be nervous about using a technology to solve the problems of technology. How can we solve that?
Well, the alternative is not to use technology. And people seem to take energy so much for granted that they don't realize that they rely on it every day. We wouldn't be able to feed people unless we had the amount of energy we had. Which is not to say that on occasion we don't waste it, right? But we have fertilizer, and without fertilizer, we couldn't feed 7 billion people. And guess what? When we make fertilizer, we first make hydrogen to make ammonia. And making that hydrogen took energy. And if you want clean water, you have to clean up water, and that requires energy. If you want raw materials, you need energy. If you want to fly from New York to Los Angeles, you need energy. If you want to have a radio system, you are consuming energy. We are consuming energy without thinking about it day in and day out. And it's not all that easy to turn this off overnight. And as a matter of fact, we can't stop using energy. What we might be able to do is change the energy infrastructure into one which doesn't produce CO2. But even that is not all that easy. People say there's a risk in relying on negative emissions like direct air capture because it's not proven. But it's also not proven that we have an energy storage system that can live with the intermittency of sunshine and wind, right? And most people are objecting to nuclear energy too. So we don't really have good answers yet, and we need to work on hard to get them. And to me, you need to look at all of these aspects, and you probably need all of the above, because no single part of this has the solution by itself. And I think it's very counterproductive to say we don't want the help of this side because we don't like this particular approach to it. This cannot be a zero-sum game, right? Because if it is a zero-sum game, we have lost.
Well, looking forward with your own work at the University of Arizona Center for Negative Carbon Emissions, what's next?
Well, one of the things I'm working on very hard is direct air capture because I think it's pivotal and central. Right? If you have the ability to pull CO2 back out of the air at an affordable price, then you can do several things. You can take that CO2 and you can dispose of it. So that's the waste disposal aspect. And in that sense, I would argue we are the sweeper, the street sweeper, which takes the CO2, which already littered the atmosphere, and take it back. But we can also close the carbon cycle together with renewable energy and observe that liquid carbon-based fuels are actually extremely good at carrying energy in the transportation sector. And nothing really prevents you from making those from CO2 and water and renewable energy, right? So we could make gasoline or methanol or whatever fuel you choose, provided we have energy, which can split water into hydrogen and oxygen and CO2 into CO and oxygen. And the CO and hydrogen we can convert into fuels. And we know how to do this since the 1920s. And Fischer-Tropsch is just one example. The Fischer-Tropsch process is just one example of how to do that. So we can close the carbon cycle that way. And right now this cannot compete because it's more expensive than taking petroleum. But in a world where you have to bury the CO2 from the petroleum, you may very well find that this option is cheaper. Not to mention, it gives an enormous bonus to or benefit to renewable energy, because these are by nature intermittent, and making fuels out of it can be a flexible consumer, right? You can turn it on whenever there is too much electricity and turn it off when there is not enough. And by the way, if there is really not enough, you can consume some of that fuel to make the electricity which is needed right here and now. So a classic example is Denmark, which is relying more and more on wind, and it more and more needs an energy storage system that can take some of the energy when there is lots of wind, and it can sell that in principle into the transportation sector where you use fuel. So in this case, we are not trying to create negative emissions, but closing the carbon cycle. But if you think of this problem as a waste management problem, in the parlance of waste management, this is reduce, reuse, recycle, right? We just figured out how to be more efficient. We got away from using fossil carbon, and we recycled the carbon through the system over and over and over again. But whenever you dump CO2 into the atmosphere, you are obligated to take it back out. And right now, I don't really know how to fly an airplane without producing CO2.
Is there anything that I've missed that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Oh, we talked so animatedly, I'm not entirely sure. Let me think about it. I did talk about the waste management analogy. I did talk about a certificate of carbon sequestration. I think ultimately we have proven that it's very, very hard to come up with a top-down solution. So I'm getting more and more to the point where I think it has to be from the bottom up. So imagine a world where you can push a button on the pump where you get your gasoline and you ask for the CO2 you just create to be taken back. Most people don't realize it, but every gallon of gasoline you burn in your car puts 20 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere. So if you get the price of air capture down to, let's say, $30 a ton, you would have to spend a quarter or more on the gallon of gasoline, and you would have balanced your book. That is also the additional cost if the fuel was made from renewable energy, plus the electricity cost which went into it. It's not the air capture cost, ultimately, which gets you. Now, can we get to $30 a ton? It's very hard to say. At the first time around, people did it with a brute force approach. They were at $600 a ton, so this would add a little more than $5 to the gallon of gasoline, and that clearly feels too expensive. And people back then said, this is hopeless. But on the other hand, photovoltaic today is 100 times cheaper than it was in the 1960s. So once you start working down this learning curve, things will get cheaper. And if you look at the startups, carbon engineering, global thermostat, the technologies we do here in a university environment, we are clearly a lot cheaper than this first one because we all have a much simpler process, right? So we all think we are probably between $100 and $200 a ton, and one of them in the group, Global Thermostat, actually thinks they are even well below that, around $50 a ton. But the proof is in the pudding, right? But that means you need somebody who actually takes it off on the other side. And so you need volunteers who help you start.
We've been talking with Dr. Klaus Lackner, a leading scientist in the search for a way to rebalance greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And I'll put links to the papers we've discussed, including Dr. Lackner's letter to the journal Science, as published on November 11th. I'll put all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Klaus Lackner, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time and your insight with us.
You're very welcome. And as you put it up there, please notice there are 44 other people signing the letter.
I will do that, and I'll put that in my blog as well. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We covered so much in this show. I'll put links for you to follow up and check our guests in my weekly show blog published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Yes, I know the blog is way too long. I hope you can scan through to find the links you need. Please take time to explore. There's everything at stake. In these times of denial, it's my honor to represent you at the sources of science and reality. Thank you for listening and for caring about our world. We'll be right back.